concerned that certain people were making false accusations about what had occurred.
You mean they thought the old girl had been deliberately killed?
Chubb took out a packet of Players, the same brand he always smoked, and lit one. The index and third fingers of his right hand were permanently stained, like old piano keys.
Well, I could put your mind at rest on that one, Herr Punt. I looked into it myself, and I could tell you it was an accident, pure and simple. She was doing the hoovering at the top of the stairs, she got tangled up in the wire and tumbled down the full length. Solid flagstone at the bottom, unlucky for her. Nobody had any reason to kill her, and anyway, she was locked in the house on her own.
And what of the death of Sir Magnus?
Well, that's quite a different kettle of fish. You can come in and take a butcher's if you like, and that's the right word for it.
I'm going to finish this first, if you don't mind. It's pretty nasty in there. He deliberately screwed the cigarette into his lips and inhaled.
At the moment, we're treating it as a burglary that went wrong. That seems the most obvious conclusion.
The most obvious conclusions are the ones I try to avoid.
Well, you have your own methods, Herr Punt, and I won't say they haven't been helpful in the past. What we've got here is a local landowner, been in the village all his life. It's early days, but I can't see that anyone would have a grudge against him. Now, someone came up here around 8:30 last night. He was actually spotted by Brent, the groundsman, as he was finishing work. He hasn't been able to give us a description, but his first impression was that it wasn't anyone from the village.
How could he know that?
Fraser asked. He had been ignored up until this moment, and felt a need to remind the others he was still there. Well, you know how it is. It's easier to recognize someone if you've seen them before. Even if you can't see their face, there's something about the shape of their body or the way they walk. Brent was fairly sure this was a stranger.
And anyway, there was something about the way this man went up to the house. It was as if he didn't want to be seen.
You believe this man was a burglar? Punt said.
The house had already been burgled once just a few days before.
Chubb sighed, as if it irritated him having to explain it all again.
After the death of the housekeeper, they had to smash a back window to get in. They should have got it reglazed, but they didn't. And a few days after that, someone broke in. They got away with a nice little haul of antique coins and jewellery. Roman, would you believe it? Maybe they had a look around while they were there. There's a safe in Sir Magnus's study, which they might have been unable to open, but now they knew it was there, they could come back and have a second crack at it. They thought the house was still empty. Sir Magnus surprised them, and there you have it.
You say he was killed violently?
That's an understatement. Chubb needed to fortify himself with another lungful of smoke. There's a suit of armor in the main hall, you'll see it in a minute, complete with sword.
He swallowed. That's what they used. They took his head clean off.
Punt considered this for a moment.
Who found him?
His wife. She'd been on a shopping trip to London, and she got home at around 9:15.
The shops closed late?
Punt half smiled. Well, maybe she had dinner too. Anyway, as she arrived, she saw a car driving off. She's not sure of the make, but it was green, and she saw a couple of letters off the registration plate, F.P., as luck would have it. They're her own initials. She came in and found him lying at the foot of the stairs, almost exactly where the body of his housekeeper had been the week before. But not all of him. His head had rolled across the floor and landed next to the fireplace.
I'm not sure you'll be able to talk to her for a while. She's in hospital in Bath, still under sedation.
She's the one who called the police, and I've heard a recording of the conversation.
Poor woman. She can hardly get the words out, screaming and sobbing. If this was a murder, you can certainly strike her off the list of suspects, unless she's the world's greatest actress.
The body, I take it, has gone.
Yes, we removed it last night. Needed a strong stomach, I can tell you. Was anything removed from this house on this second occasion, Detective Inspector?
It's hard to be sure. We'll need to interview Lady Pye when she's up to it, but on first appearance it doesn't seem so. You can come in if you like, Herr Punt. You're not here in any official capacity, of course, and maybe I should have a quick word with the Assistant Commissioner, but I'm sure no harm can come of it. And if anything does spring to mind, I can rely on you to let me know.
Of course, Detective Inspector, Punt said, although Fraser knew that he would do no such thing. He had accompanied Punt on separate inquiries and knew that the detective had a maddening habit of keeping everything under his hat until it suited him to reveal the truth. They climbed three steps, but Punt stopped before he entered the front door. He crouched down.
Now that is strange, he said.
Chubb gazed at him in disbelief. Are you going to tell me that I've missed something? He demanded. And we haven't even gone inside.
It may have no relevance at all, Detective Inspector, he replied soothingly. But you see the flower bed beside the door?
Fraser glanced down. There were flower beds running all the way along the front of the house, divided by the steps that led up from the driveway.
Petunias, if I'm not mistaken, Chubb remarked.
Of that I am unsure. But do you not see the handprint?
Both Chubb and Fraser looked more closely. It was true. Somebody had stuck their hand in the soft earth, just to the left of the door. From the size of it, Fraser would have said that it belonged to a man. The fingers were outstretched.
It was very odd, Fraser thought. A footprint would have been more conventional.
It probably belongs to the gardener, Chubb said. I can't think of any other explanation.
And you are probably right.
Punt sprang back to his feet and continued forward. The door led directly into a large rectangular room with a staircase in front of them and two more doors left and right. Fraser saw at once where the body of Sir Magnus had lain, and he felt the usual stirring in the pit of his stomach. There was a Persian rug, gleaming darkly, still soaked with blood. The blood had spread onto the flagstones, stretching towards the fireplace, encircling the legs of one of the leather chairs that stood there. The whole room stank of it. A sword lay diagonally with its hilt close to the stairs, its blade pointing towards the head of a deer that looked down with glass eyes, perhaps the only witness to what had occurred. The rest of the armour, an empty knight, stood beside one of the doors with a living room beyond. Fraser had been to many crime scenes with his employer. Often he had seen the bodies lying there, stabbed, shot, drowned, whatever. But it struck him that there was something particularly macabre about this one. Almost Jacobean, with the dark wooden panelling and the minstrel gallery.
Sir Magnus knew the person who killed him, Punt muttered.
How can you possibly know? Fraser asked.
The position of the suit of armour and the layout of the room, Punt gestured.
See for yourself, James. The entrance is behind us. The armour and the sword are further inside the room. If the killer had come to the front door and wished to attack Sir Magnus, it would have been necessary to go round him to reach the weapon, and at that moment, if the door was open, Sir Magnus could have made good his escape. However, it seems more likely that Sir Magnus was showing someone out.
They come in from the living room. Sir Magnus is first. His killer is behind him. As he opens the front door, he does not see that his guest has drawn out the sword. He turns, sees the guest moving towards him, perhaps pleads with him. The killer strikes, and all is as we see it.
It still might have been a stranger.
You would invite a stranger into the house late in the evening?
I do not think so.
Punt looked around him. There is a painting missing, he remarked. Fraser followed his eyes and saw that it was true. There was a bare hook on the wall next to the door, and a section of the woodwork had faded slightly,
a telltale rectangle that clearly delineated the missing work of art.
"Do you think it could be relevant?"
Fraser asked.
"Everything is relevant," Punt replied.
He took one last look around him. "There is nothing more for me to see here. It would be interesting to learn exactly how the housekeeper was discovered when she died 2 weeks ago, but we will come to that in due course. Can we proceed into the living room?"
"Of course," Chubb said. "The door leads into the living room, and Sir Magnus had his study on the other side. There's a letter we found there that may interest you."
The living room had a much more feminine feel than the entrance hall, with an oyster-pink carpet, plush curtains with a floral pattern, comfortable sofas and occasional tables. There were photographs everywhere. Fraser picked one up and examined the three people standing together in front of the house. A round-faced man with a beard, wearing an old-fashioned suit. Next to him, a few inches taller than him, a woman staring into the camera lens with a look of impatience, and a boy in school uniform, scowling. It was obviously a family photograph, if not a particularly happy one. Sir Magnus, Lady Pye, and their son. A uniformed policeman stood, guarding the door on the far side. They went straight through into a room dominated by an antique desk, set square between two bookshelves with windows opposite giving views across the front lawn and down to the lake. The floor was polished, wooden boards partly covered by another rug. Two armchairs faced into the room, with an antique globe between them. The far wall was dominated by a fireplace, and it was evident from the ashes and charred wood that someone had recently lit a fire. Everything smelled faintly of cigar smoke. Fraser noticed a humidor and a heavy glass ashtray on a side table. The wooden panelling from the entrance hall was picked up again with several more oil paintings, which might have hung here as long as the house itself. Punt went over to one of them, a picture of a horse in front of a stable, very much in the style of Stubbs. He had noticed it because it was slightly perpendicular to the wall, like a half-open door.
"It was like that when we came in," Chubb remarked.
Punt took a pen out of his pocket and used it to hook the painting, pulling it towards him. It was hinged along one side and concealed a very solid-looking safe set in the wall.
"We don't know the combination," Chubb continued. "I'm sure Lady Pye will tell us when she's up to it."
Punt nodded and transferred his attention to the desk. It was quite likely that Sir Magnus had been sitting here in the hours before he died, and that therefore the papers strewn across the surface might have something to say about what had actually happened.
"There's a gun in the top drawer," Chubb said. "An old service revolver. It hasn't been fired, but it's loaded. According to Lady Pye, he usually kept it in the safe. He might have brought it out because of the burglary."
"Or it could be that Sir Magnus had reason to be nervous."
Punt opened the drawer and glanced at the gun. It was indeed a .38 Webley revolver. And Chubb was right. It had not been used. He closed the drawer and turned his attention to the surface of the desk, beginning with a series of drawings, architectural blueprints from a company called Larkin Gadwall, based in Bath. They showed a cluster of houses, 12 in total, stretching out in two lines of six. A number of letters were piled up next to it, correspondence with the local council, a paper trail that must ultimately lead to the granting of planning permission. And here was the proof of it, a smart brochure with the heading Dingle Drive, Saxby-on-Avon. All of these occupied one corner of the desk. A telephone stood at the other, with a notepad next to it. Someone, presumably Sir Magnus, had written in pencil. The pencil itself lay nearby. Ashton H. M.W. A girl. The words were written neatly at the top of the page, but after that, Sir Magnus must have become agitated. There were several lines crossing each other, an angry scrawl. Punt handed the page to Fraser. "A girl," Fraser asked. These would seem to be notes taken down from a telephone conversation,
Punt suggested.
M.W. may stand for something. Note that the W is in lower case. And the girl, perhaps it is the subject of which they spoke. Well, he doesn't seem to have been too pleased about it.
Indeed not.
Finally, Punt turned to an empty envelope, and next to it, the letter that Chubb must have been referring to, and which lay at the very center of the desk. There was no address, just a name, Sir Magnus Pye, handwritten in black ink. It had been roughly torn open. Punt took out a handkerchief and used it to pick up the envelope. He examined the paper carefully, then replaced it, and with equal care picked up the letter beside it. This was typewritten and addressed to Sir Magnus Pye with a date, the 28th of July, 1955, the actual day that the murder had taken place. He read,
"You think you can get away with it? This village was here before you, and it will be here after you. And if you think you can ruin it with your building and your money-making, you are so, so wrong. Think again, you bastard, if you want to live here. If you want to live."
The letter was not signed. He laid it back on the desk so that Fraser could read it.
"Whoever wrote this can't spell building," Fraser remarked. "He may also be a homicidal maniac," Punt added gently. "This letter would seem to have been delivered yesterday. Sir Magnus was killed a matter of hours after it arrived, which is what was promised."
He turned to the detective inspector. "I would imagine this relates in some way to the diagrams," he said.
"That's right," Chubb agreed. "I've put a call into these people, Larkin Gadwall. They're developers in Bath, and it seems they had some sort of deal with Sir Magnus. I'll be heading their way this afternoon, and you can join me if you like."
"You're most generous," Punt nodded.
His attention was still focused on the letter. "There is something about this that I find a little peculiar," he said.
"I think I'm ahead of you there, Punt."
The detective beamed, pleased with himself. "The envelope is handwritten, even though the letter is typed. You'd have thought that would be a dead giveaway if the sender wanted to hide his or her identity. My guess is they sealed the letter first, then realized they needed to put the name on the front, but it wouldn't fit into the typewriter. I've done the same myself often enough."
"You may well be right, Detective Inspector, but that was not the peculiarity that had occurred to me."
Chubb waited for him to continue, but standing on the other side of the desk, James Fraser knew that he would do no such thing. He was right. Punt had already turned his attention to the fireplace. He took the pen back out of his jacket pocket and rummaged around in the ashes, found something, carefully separated it from the rest. Fraser went over and looked down at a scrap of paper, barely larger than a cigarette card, blackened at the edges. This was the sort of moment he loved, working with Punt. It would never have occurred to Chubb to examine the fireplace. The policeman would have taken a cursory look at the room, called for forensics, and then been on his way. But here was a clue, and one that might crack the case wide open. The fragment might have a name written on it. Even a few letters would provide a handwriting sample which might indicate who had been in the room. Sadly, however, in this case, the paper was blank, although Punt did not seem dispirited. Far from it.
"You see, Fraser," he exclaimed, "there is a slight discoloration, a stain, and I think it will be possible to discern at least part of a fingerprint."
"A fingerprint?" Chubb had heard the word and came over.
Fraser looked more closely and saw that Punt was right. The stain was dark brown in color, and his immediate thought was spilled coffee. But at the same time, he could see no obvious relevance. Anyone could have torn up a sheet of paper and thrown it in the fire. Sir Magnus might well have done it himself.
"I'll get the lab to have a look at it," Chubb said, "and they can run their eye over that letter too. It's just possible I may have jumped to conclusions, thinking about that burglar.
Punt nodded. He straightened up.
We must find accommodation, he announced suddenly.
You're planning to stay?
With your permission, Detective Inspector?
Absolutely.
I believe they have rooms at the Queen's Arms. It's a pub next to the church, but they do B&B too. If you want a hotel, you'd be better off in Bath.
It will be more convenient to remain in the village, Punt replied. Fraser sighed inwardly, imagining the lumpy beds, ugly furniture and spluttering bath taps that always seemed to accompany local hospitality. He had no money himself apart from what Punt paid him, and that was little enough. But that didn't prevent him from having expensive tastes.
Do you want me to check it out? He asked.
We can go there together.
He turned to Chubb. What time will you be travelling to Bath?
I have an appointment at Larkin Gadwall at 2 o'clock, and we can go straight from there to the hospital and see Lady Pye, if you like.
That is excellent, Detective Inspector. I must say that it is a great pleasure to be working with you again.
Likewise. I'm very glad to see you, Herr Punt. Headless bodies and all that. The moment I got the call, I knew this was right up your street. Lighting another cigarette, he made his way back to his car.
Chapter 2. To Fraser's chagrin, the Queen's Arms had 2 rooms vacant, and without even going upstairs to examine them, Punt took them both. They were as bad as he had imagined, too, with sloping floors and windows too small for the walls in which they were set. He had a view of the village square. Punt looked out over the cemetery, but made no complaint. On the contrary, there was something about the view that seemed to amuse him. Nor did he complain about the lack of comfort. When he had first started working at Tanner Court, Fraser had been surprised to discover that the detective slept in a single bed, more a cot, really, with a metal frame, the blankets neatly folded back. Although Punt had once been married, he never spoke of his wife, and showed no further interest in the opposite sex. But even so, such austerity in a smart London flat seemed more than a little eccentric. The two of them had lunch together downstairs, then stepped outside. There was a small crowd of people gathered around the bus shelter in the village square, but Fraser got the impression that they were not waiting for a bus. Something had clearly interested them. They were talking in an animated sort of way. He was sure that Punt would want to go over and see what the fuss was about, but at that moment a figure appeared in the cemetery, walking towards them. It was the vicar. That much was obvious from his clerical shirt and dog collar. He was tall and lanky with unkempt black hair. Fraser watched as he picked up a bicycle that had been resting against the gate and guided it out onto the road, the wheels creaking noisily with every turn. "The vicar," Punt exclaimed. "In an English village, he is the one man who knows everyone."
"Not everyone goes to church,"
Fraser returned. "They do not need to. He makes it his business to know even the atheists and the agnostics." They went over to him and intercepted him before he could make his getaway. Punt introduced himself.
"Oh, yes," the vicar exclaimed, blinking in the sunlight. He frowned. "I know the name, I'm sure. The detective? You're here, of course, because of Sir Magnus Pye. What a terrible, terrible business. A small community like Saxby-on-Avon cannot be prepared in any way for such an event, and it is going to be very hard for us to come to terms with it. But forgive me, I haven't told you my name. Robin Osborne. I'm the vicar here at St. Botolph's." "Well, you had probably worked that out for yourself, given your line of work." He laughed, and it occurred to Punt, it had even occurred to Fraser, that this was an exceptionally nervous man, that he was almost unable to stop talking, and that the words were pouring out of him in an attempt to cover up whatever was actually passing through his mind.
"I would imagine that you knew Sir Magnus quite well,"
Punt said. Passably well, yes. Sadly, I saw him less than I would have liked. Not a very religious man. He came to services all too seldom. Osborne drew himself in. Are you here to investigate the crime, Mr. Punt?
Punt replied that this was the case.
I'm a little surprised that our own police force should need any extra assistance. Not, of course, that it is in any way unwelcome. I already spoke to Detective Inspector Chubb this morning. He suggested to me that it may have been an intruder. Burglars. You are aware, I'm sure, that Pye Hall was targeted very recently.
Pye Hall appears to have had more than its fair share of misfortune.
The death of Mary Blakiston, you mean? Osborne pointed. She is resting just over there. I officiated myself.
Was Sir Magnus popular in the village?
The question took the vicar by surprise, and he struggled to find the right answer. There may have been those who envied him. He had considerable wealth. And then, of course, there was the matter of Dingle Dell. It would be true to say that it aroused strong feelings.
Dingle Dell.
It's a strip of woodland. He had sold it.
To Larkin Gadwall,
Fraser interceded.
Yes, those are the developers, I believe.
Would you be surprised to learn, Mr. Osborne, that Sir Magnus had received a death threat as a direct result of his intentions?
A death threat? The vicar was more flustered than ever. I would be very surprised. I'm sure nobody around here would send such a thing. This is a very peaceful village. The people who live here aren't like that at all.
And yet you spoke of strong feelings.
People were upset, but that's not the same thing.
When did you last see Sir Magnus?
Robin Osborne was keen to be on his way. He was holding his bicycle as if it were an animal straining at the leash. And this last question offended him. It was clear in his eyes. Was he being suspected of something?
I haven't seen him for a while, he replied. He was unable to attend Mary Blakiston's burial, which was a pity, but he was in the south of France, and before that I was away myself.
Where?
On holiday, with my wife.
Punt waited for more, and Osborne obligingly filled in the silence. We had a week together in Devonshire. Actually, she'll be waiting for me right now, so if you don't mind... With a half-smile, he pushed his way between them, the gears of his bicycle grinding.
I'd say that he was nervous about something, Fraser muttered.
Yes, James, he was certainly a man with something to hide.
As the detective and his assistant made their way towards their car, Robin Osborne was cycling as quickly as he could down to the vicarage. He knew he had not been entirely honest. Not lying, but omitting certain aspects of the truth. It was true, however, that Henrietta was waiting for him and would have expected him some time ago.
"Where have you been?" she asked, as he took his place in the kitchen.
She served a homemade quiche with a bean salad and sat down next to him.
"Oh, I was just in the village."
Osborne mouthed a silent grace.
"I met that detective," he went on, barely leaving time for the amen.
"Atticus Punt."
"Who?"
"You must have heard of him. He's quite famous. A private detective. You remember that school in Marlborough? There was a teacher who was killed during a play. He worked on that."
"But why do we need a private detective? I thought it was a burglar."
"It seems the police may have been wrong." Osborne hesitated. "He thinks it has something to do with the Dell."
"The Dell?"
"That's what he thinks." They ate in silence. Neither of them seemed to be enjoying the food. Then Henrietta spoke quite suddenly.
"Where did you go last night, Robin?" she asked.
"What?"
"You know what I'm talking about. Sir Magnus being killed."
"Why on earth would you ask me such a thing?" Osborne put down his knife and fork. He took a sip of water.
"I felt anger," he explained. "It's one of the mortal sins. And there were things in my heart that should not have been there.
I was upset because of the news, but that's no excuse. I needed to spend time alone, so I went up to the church.
But you were gone such a long time.
It wasn't easy for me, Henrietta. I needed the time. She wasn't going to speak, then thought again.
Robin, I was so worried about you, I came out looking for you. As a matter of fact, I bumped into Brent, and he said he'd seen someone going up to the hall.
What are you suggesting, Hen? Do you think I went up to Pye Hall and killed him? Took his head off with a sword? Is that what you're saying?
No, of course not. It's just that you were so angry.
You're being ridiculous. I didn't go anywhere near the house. I didn't see anything. There was something else Henrietta wanted to say. The bloodstain on her husband's sleeve. She had seen it with her own eyes. The following morning she had taken the shirt and washed it in boiling water and bleach. It was on the washing line even now, drying in the sun. She wanted to ask him whose blood it was. She wanted to know how it had got there. But she didn't dare. She couldn't accuse him. Such a thing was impossible. The two of them finished their lunch in silence. Chapter 3. Sitting in a reproduction captain's chair with its curved back and swiveling seat, Johnny Whitehead was also thinking about the murder. Indeed, throughout the morning, he had thought of little else, blundering around like a bull in his own china shop, rearranging objects for no reason and smoking incessantly. Gemma Whitehead had finally lost her temper with him when he had knocked over and broken a nice little Meissen soap dish, which, though chipped, had still been priced at 9 shillings and 6 pence.
"What is the matter with you?" she demanded. "You're like a bear with a sore head today, and that's your fourth cigarette. Why did you go out and get some fresh air?"
"I don't want to go out," Johnny said moodily.
"What's wrong?"
Johnny stubbed out his cigarette in a Royal Doulton ashtray, shaped like a cow, and priced at 6 shillings.
"What do you think?" he snapped. "I don't know. That's why I'm asking you."
"Sir Magnus Pye, that's what's wrong." He stared at the smoke still rising from the twisted cigarette butt. "Why did someone have to go and murder him? Now we've got the police in the village knocking on doors, asking questions. They'll be here soon enough."
"What does it matter? They can ask us anything they want."
There was a fractional pause, long enough to make itself felt.
"Can't they?"
"Of course they can." She examined him, a sharp look in her eye.
"You haven't been up to anything, have you, Johnny?"
"What are you talking about?" There was a wounded tone in his voice.
"Why do you even ask that? Of course I haven't been up to anything. What could I possibly get up to, stuck out here in the sticks?"
It was the old argument. City versus countryside, Saxby versus almost anywhere else in the world. They'd had it often enough. But even as he spoke the words, he was remembering how Mary Blakiston had confronted him all too recently in this very building, how much she had known about him. She had died suddenly, and so had Sir Magnus, both of them within 2 weeks of each other. That wasn't a coincidence, and the police certainly wouldn't think so. Johnny knew how they worked. They would already be drawing up files, looking at everyone who lived in the neighbourhood. It wouldn't be too long before they came after him. Gemma came over and sat down next to him, laying a hand on his arm. Although she was so much smaller than him, so much frailer, she was the one with the strength, and they both knew it. She had stood by him when they'd had their troubles in London. She had written to him every week, long letters full of optimism and good cheer, when he was away. And when he had finally come home, it had been her decision that had brought them to Saxby-on-Avon. She had seen the antique shop advertised in a magazine and had thought it would allow Johnny to maintain some of the practices of his old life whilst providing a stable, honest basis for the new. Leaving London had not been easy, especially for a boy who had lived his whole life within earshot of the Bow Bells, but Johnny had seen the sense of it and had reluctantly gone along with it.
but she knew that he had been diminished by it. Loud, cheerful, trusting, irascible Johnny Whitehead could never be completely at home in a community where everyone was being endlessly judged and where disapproval could mean total ostracism. Had it been wrong of her to bring him here? She still allowed him trips back to the city, although they always made her nervous. She didn't ask him what he got up to, and he didn't tell her. But this time, it was different. He had been there only a few days before. Could that visit possibly be connected with what had happened?
"What did you do in London?" she asked.
"Why do you want to know?"
"I was just wondering."
"I saw some of the blokes, Derek and Colin. We had lunch. A few drinks. You should have come."
"You wouldn't want me there."
"They asked after you. I went past the old house. It's flats now. It made me think. We had a lot of happy times there, you and me." Johnny patted the back of his wife's hand, noticing how thin it had become. The older she got, the less of her there seemed to be.
"I've had enough of London for one lifetime, Johnny."
She withdrew her hand. "And as for Derek and Colin, they were never your friends. They didn't stand by you when things went belly up."
"I did."
Johnny scowled. "You're right," he said. "I'm going out for a walk. Half an hour. That'll blow away the cobwebs."
"I'll come with you if you like."
"No. You'd better mind the shop."
Nobody had come in since they had opened that morning. That was another thing about murder. It discouraged the tourists.
She watched him leave, heard the bell on the door make its familiar jangle. Gemma had thought they would be all right coming here, leaving their former lives behind them. No matter what Johnny had said at the time, it had been the right decision. But two deaths, one following hard upon the other, had changed everything. It was as if those old shadows had somehow stretched out and found them. Mary Blakiston had been here. For the first time in a very, very long time, the housekeeper had come to the shop, and when challenged, Johnny had lied about it. He had claimed she was buying someone a present, but Gemma knew that wasn't true. If Mary had wanted a present, she would have gone into Bath, to Woolworth or Boots the chemist. And less than a week later, she had died. Was there some link between the two events? And if so, was there a further link that led to the death of Sir Magnus Pye? Gemma Whitehead had come to Saxby-on-Avon because she thought it would be safe. Sitting alone in the dingy shop, surrounded by hundreds of unnecessary items, trinkets and knick-knacks which nobody seemed to want, and which today anyway nobody had come in to buy, she wished with all her heart that she and Johnny could be anywhere else. Chapter 4. Everyone in the village thought they knew who had killed Sir Magnus Pye. Unfortunately, no two theories were the same. It was well known that Sir Magnus and Lady Pye were at loggerheads. They were seldom seen together. If they turned up at church, they kept a distance between them. According to Gareth Kite, the landlord of the Ferryman, Sir Magnus had been having an affair with his housekeeper, Mary Blakiston. Lady Pye had killed both of them, although how she had managed the first death when she was on holiday in France, he hadn't explained. No, no, it was Robert Blakiston who was the killer. Hadn't he threatened his mother just days before she died? He had killed her because he was angry with her and had gone on to kill Sir Magnus when he had somehow discovered the truth. And then there was Brent. The groundsman lived alone. He was definitely peculiar. There were rumours that Sir Magnus had fired him the very day that he had died. Or what about the stranger who had come to the funeral? Nobody wore a hat like that, unless it was to conceal their identity. Even Joy Sanderling, that nice girl who worked for Dr. Redwing, was suspected. The strange announcement that had gone up on the notice board next to the bus shelter definitely showed that there was more to her than met the eye. Mary Blakiston had taken against her. So she had died. Sir Magnus Pye had found out. He had died too. And then there was the destruction of Dingle Dell. Although the police had not released details of the threatening message that had been found on Sir Magnus's desk, it was well known how much anger the proposed development had provoked. The longer you had lived in the village, the more angry you were likely to be. And by this logic, old Jeff Weaver, who was 83, and who had tended the churchyard for as long as anyone could remember, became the number one suspect. The vicar, too, had plenty to lose. The vicarage backed directly onto the proposed development site, and it had often been remarked how he and Mrs. Osborne liked to lose themselves in the wood. Curiously, one resident who had every reason to kill Sir Magnus, but whose name had been left out of the loop, was Clarissa Pye. The impoverished sister had been by turns ignored and humiliated, but it had not occurred to any of the villagers that this might make her a murderess. Perhaps it was the fact that she was a single woman, and a religious one at that. Perhaps it was her eccentric appearance. The dyed hair was absurd, visible at 50 yards. She tried too hard with her hats, her imitation jewellery, her wardrobe of once fashionable cast-offs, when really simpler, more modern clothes would have suited her better. Her physique was against her, too. Not fat, not masculine, not dumpy, but perilously close to all three. In short, she was something of a joke in Saxby-on-Avon, and jokes do not commit murder. Sitting in her home in Winsley Terrace, Clarissa was trying not to think about what had happened. For the last hour, she'd been absorbed by the Daily Telegraph crossword, though normally she'd finish it in half that time. One clue in particular had confounded her. 16. Complained endlessly about Bobby. The answer was a 9-letter word, the second letter O, the fourth letter I. She knew that it was staring her in the face, but for some reason it wouldn't come to her. Was the solution a synonym of complained, or was it somebody famous, first name Bobby? It seemed very unlikely. The Telegraph crossword didn't usually involve celebrities unless they were classical writers or artists. In which case, could Bobby have some other meaning that had eluded her? She chewed briefly on the Parker jotter that was her special crossword pen. And then, quite suddenly, it hit her. The answer was so obvious. It had been in front of her all the time. Complained endlessly. So, drop the D at the end of the word. About, indicating an anagram. And a Bobby? Perhaps the capital B was a little unfair. She entered the missing letters. Policeman. And of course, that made her think of Magnus, of the police cars she had seen driving through the village, the uniformed officers who would be up at Pye Hall even now. What would happen to the house now that her brother was dead? Presumably Francis would continue living there. She wasn't allowed to sell it. That was all part of the entail, the complicated document that had defined the ownership of Pye Hall over the centuries. It would now pass to her nephew, Freddy, the next in line. He was only 15 years old, and the last time Clarissa had seen him, he had struck her as shallow and arrogant, a little like his father. And now he was a millionaire. Of course, if he and his mother died, if, for example, there was a terrible car accident, then the property, but not the title, would have to move sideways. That was an interesting thought. Unlikely, but interesting. Really, there was no reason why it couldn't happen. First Mary Blakiston, then Sir Magnus, finally... Clarissa heard a key turning in the front door and quickly folded the newspaper and set it aside. She wouldn't want anyone to think that she had been wasting time, that she had nothing to do. She was already on her feet and moving towards the kitchen as the door opened and Diana Weaver came in, the wife of Adam Weaver, who did odd jobs around the village and helped out at the church. She was a comfortably middle-aged woman with a no-nonsense attitude and a friendly smile. She worked as a cleaner, 2 hours a day at the doctor's surgery and the rest of the week divided between various houses in Saxby-on-Avon, with just one afternoon once a week here. Seeing her as she bustled in with the oversized plastic bag she always carried, already buttoning the coat, which surely wasn't needed on such a warm day, it occurred to Clarissa that this was a real cleaning lady, which is to say, a lady for whom such work was entirely appropriate and indeed necessary. How could Magnus have possibly placed her in the same category? Had he really been serious, or had he come here simply to insult her? She wasn't sorry he was dead. Quite the opposite.
"Good afternoon, Mrs. Weaver," she said.
"Hello there, Miss Pye." Clarissa could tell at once that something was wrong. The cleaner was downcast. She seemed nervous.
"There's some ironing to do in the spare bedroom, and I've bought a new bottle of Ajax."
Clarissa had got straight to the point. It wasn't her habit to engage in conversation. It wasn't just a question of propriety. She could barely afford to pay for the 2 hours each week, and she wasn't going to eat into them with small talk. But although Mrs. Weaver had divested herself of her coat, she hadn't moved and didn't seem in any hurry to start work.
"Is something the matter?" she asked.
"Well, it's this business at the big house."
"My brother?"
"Yes, Miss Pye."
The cleaner seemed more upset than she had any right to be. It wasn't as if she had worked there. She had probably only spoken to Magnus once or twice in her life.
"It's a horrible thing to happen," she went on, "in a village like this. I mean, people have their ups and their downs, but I've lived here 40 years and I've never known anything like it. First poor Mary, and now this."
"I was just thinking about it myself," Clarissa agreed. "I am mortified. My brother and I weren't close, but even so, he was still blood."
Blood. She shuddered. Had he known he was about to die?
"And now we've got the police here,"
Diana Weaver continued, asking questions and disturbing everyone. Was that what she was worried about? The police? "Do you think they have any idea who did it?"
"I doubt it. It only happened last night."
"I'm sure they'll have searched the house. According to my Adam..."
She paused, unsure whether to spell it out.
"Someone took his head clean off his shoulders."
"Yes, that's what I heard."
"That's horrible."
"It certainly was very shocking."
"Are you going to be able to work today, or would you like to go home?"
No, I prefer to keep myself busy."
The cleaner went into the kitchen. Clarissa glanced at the clock. Mrs. Weaver had actually started work 2 minutes late. She would make sure she made up the time before she left. Chapter 5. The meeting at Larkin Gadwall had not been particularly illuminating. Atticus Punt had been shown the brochure for the new development. Everything in watercolour, with smiling families, sketched in almost like ghosts, drifting through their new paradise. Planning permission had been approved. Construction was due to start the following spring. Philip Gadwall, the senior partner, insisted that Dingle Dell was an unremarkable piece of woodland, and that the new homes would benefit the neighbourhood. "It's very much in the council's mind that we regenerate our villages. We need new homes for local families if we're going to keep the villages alive." Chubb had listened to all this in silence. It struck him that the families in the brochure, with their smart clothes and brand new cars, didn't look local at all. He was quite glad when Punt announced that he had no further questions and they were able to get back out into the street. It turned out that Francis Pye had already left hospital and had insisted on returning home, so that was where the three men, Punt, Fraser and Chubb, went next. The police cars had already left Pye Hall by the time they arrived. Driving past the lodge and up the gravel driveway, Punt was struck by how normal everything looked with the afternoon sun already dipping behind the trees. That must have been where Mary Blakiston lived. Fraser said, pointing to the silent lodge house as they passed.
At one time with her two sons, Robert and Tom, Punt said. Let us not forget that the younger of the two children also died. He gazed out of the window, his face suddenly grim. This place has seen a lot of death.
They pulled in. Chubb had driven ahead of them and was waiting for them at the front door. A square of police tape hung limply around the handprint in the soil, and Fraser wondered if it had been linked to the gardener, Brent, or to anyone else. They went straight into the house. Someone had been busy. The Persian rug had been removed, the flagstones washed down. The suit of armour had gone too. The police would have held on to the sword, it was after all the murder weapon, but the rest of the armour would have been too grim a reminder of what had occurred. The whole house was silent. There was no sign of Lady Pye. Chubb hesitated, unsure how to proceed. And then a door opened and a man appeared, coming out of the living room. He was in his late 30s, with dark hair and a moustache, wearing a blue blazer with a crest on the front pocket. He had a lazy walk, one hand in his pocket and a cigarette in the other. Fraser had the immediate thought that this was a man whom it would be easy to dislike. He did not just arouse antipathy, he almost seemed to cultivate it. The new arrival was surprised to find three visitors in the hall, and he didn't try to conceal it.
"Who are you?" he demanded. "I was about to ask you the same," Chubb replied, already bristling. "I'm with the police."
"Oh." The man's face fell. "Well, I'm a friend of Francis's, Lady Pye. I've come down from London to look after her. Hour of need and all that. The name's Dartford. Jack Dartford." He held a hand out vaguely, then withdrew it. "She's very upset, you know."
"I'm sure."
Punt stepped forward. "I would be interested to know how you heard the news, Mr. Dartford."
"About Magnus? She rang me."
"Today?" "No, last night, immediately after she'd called the police. She was actually quite hysterical. I'd have come down straight away, but it was a bit late to hit the road, and I had meetings this morning, so I said I'd arrive around lunchtime, which is what I did. Picked her up at the hospital and brought her here. Her son, Freddie, is with her, by the way. He'd been staying with friends on the south coast." "You will forgive me for asking, but I wonder why she selected you out of all of her friends in what you term her hour of need."
"Well, that's easy enough to explain, Mr.
Punt." "Punt? That's a German name, and you've got the accent to go with it. What are you doing here?"
"Mr. Punt is helping us," Chubb cut in shortly.
"Oh, all right. What was the question? Why did she ask me?" For all his bluster, it was evident that Jack Dartford was casting around for a safe answer.
"Well, I suppose it was because we'd just had lunch together. I actually went with her to the station and put her on the train back to Bath. I'd have been uppermost in her mind."
"Lady Pye was with you in London on the day of the murder?" Punt asked.
"Yes." Dartford half sighed, as if he had given away more than he had intended. "We had a business lunch. I advised her about stocks and shares and investments, that sort of thing."
"And what did you do after lunch, Mr. Dartford?"
"I just told you. You told us that you accompanied Lady Pye to the station, but we know that she came to Bath on a late evening train. She reached the house around 9:30. I take it, therefore, that you spent the afternoon together."
"Yes, we did."
Dartford was looking increasingly uncomfortable. "We killed a bit of time," he thought for a moment. "We went to a gallery, the Royal Academy."
"What did you see?"
"Just some paintings, dreary stuff."
"Lady Pye has said that she went shopping."
"We did a bit of shopping, too. Well, she didn't buy anything, though, not that I can remember. She wasn't really in the mood." I have one last question for you, if you will forgive me, Mr. Dartford. You say that you are a friend of Lady Pye. Would you have described yourself as a friend of the late Sir Magnus, too?
No, not really. I mean, I knew him, of course. I quite liked him, decent enough sort of chap. But Francis and I used to play tennis together. That's how we met. So I saw rather more of her than of him. Not that he minded, but he wasn't particularly sporty. That's all.
Where is Lady Pye? Chubb asked.
She's in her room upstairs. She's in bed.
Asleep?
I don't think so. She wasn't when I looked in a few minutes ago.
Then we would like to see her.
Now?
Dartford saw the answer in the detective's implacable face.
All right. I'll take you up.
Chapter 6. Frances Pye was lying on her bed, wrapped in a dressing gown and half submerged in a wave of crumpled sheets. She had been drinking champagne. There was a half-empty glass on the table beside her, along with a bottle slanting out of an ice bucket. Sedative or celebration? To Fraser's eye, it could have been either, and the look on her face as they came in was just as hard to decipher. She was annoyed to be interrupted, but at the same time, she had been expecting it. She was reluctant to talk, but had already geared herself up to answer the questions that must come her way. She was not alone. A teenaged boy, dressed in whites as if for cricket, lounged in a chair, one leg crossed over the other. He was obviously her son. He had the same dark hair swept back across his forehead, the same haughty eyes. He was eating an apple. Neither mother nor son looked particularly grieved by what had happened. She could have been in bed with a touch of flu. He could have been visiting her. Francis, Jack Dartford introduced them. This is Detective Inspector Chubb. He's from the Bath Police.
We saw each other briefly the night it happened, Chubb reminded her. I was there when you were taken off in the ambulance.
Oh, yes.
The voice was husky, uninterested. And this is Mr. Pond.
Punt.
Punt nodded his head. I am assisting the police. My assistant, James Fraser. They want to ask you a few questions.
Dartford was deliberately attempting to insinuate himself into the room. I'll hang around if you like.
That's all right, thank you, Mr. Dartford. Chubb answered the question for her. We'll call you if we need you.
I really don't think I ought to leave Frances on her own.
We won't keep her very long.
It's all right, Jack.
Frances Pye settled back onto the pile of cushions that had been heaped up behind her. She turned to the three unwanted visitors.
I suppose we ought to get this over with.
There was a brief moment of awkwardness as Dartford tried to work out what to do next, and even Fraser could see what was going through his mind. He wanted to tell her what he had said about the London visit. He wanted to make sure that her account tallied with his, but there was no way Punt was going to allow that to happen. Separate the suspects, set them against each other. That was how he worked. Dartford left. Chubb closed the door, and Fraser drew up three chairs. There was plenty of furniture in the bedroom, which was large, with tumbling curtains, thick carpets, fitted wardrobes, and an antique dressing table whose bowed legs seemed barely up to the weight of all the bottles, boxes, bowls, and brushes piled up on the surface. Fraser, who liked to read Charles Dickens, thought at once of Miss Havisham in Great Expectations. The whole room was chintzy, slightly Victorian. All that was missing was the cobwebs.
Punt sat down. I'm afraid I have to ask you some questions about your husband, he began.
I quite understand. It's a ghastly business. Who would do such a thing? Please, go ahead.
You might prefer to ask your son to leave.
But I want to stay, Freddy protested. There was a certain arrogance in his voice, all the more inappropriate as it hadn't yet broken. I've never met a real detective.
He stared insolently at Punt.
How come you've got a foreign name? Do you work for Scotland Yard?
Don't be rude, Freddy, his mother said. You can stay, but only if you don't interrupt. Her eyes flickered over to Punt.